In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And welcome to another edition of the iSpy Radio Show, getting you a little more intelligence on big government. This week, we are continuing a theme from last week, looking at the Las Vegas shooting incident. Last week, we talked with Kamal Saleem, a former jihadist, about what the identifiers would be if the shooter had had some help from terrorist organizations. Very revealing show. I would highly encourage you to go listen to that if you haven't already. You can find the podcast in the archive. No sign-up needed. It's just there for your information. There's a lot of questions that still remain about the mass shooting in Las Vegas, especially questions about the new timeline. Why such significant changes? But the new timeline and some other confusion from officials are now raising questions about the police investigation itself. To help you understand what's going on, we'll talk today with law enforcement expert Doug Wiley to analyze the process of the investigation, including how information is gathered and how and when it is released to the public. Speaking of the government, have you ever wondered why it is that some government bureaucrat can completely screw up but never be held accountable? We will talk with New York Times bestselling author David Hardy about his just-released book, I'm From the Government, and I'm Here to Kill You, The True Human Cost of Official Negligence. Why aren't government officials held accountable? Why can't they be held accountable? And as you'll hear, it's way worse than overspending or sheer incompetence. Way worse. Stay tuned for that. I'd like to welcome Doug Wiley. He is the editor-at-large for Police One. That is the most comprehensive and trusted online destination for law enforcement agencies and police departments worldwide. You can visit them at policeone.com, and one is spelled out. Doug, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Mark Anderson, it's a pleasure to talk with you. It has been too long.
Yes, it has. I'd like to preface this first segment here by saying that the law enforcement officers, the sheriff's office, and all the rest have done really outstanding work, and we're not trying to take anything away from them. However, there's been some new information that's coming out that has led to some confusion by the public. So our questions here are to try to understand both the information and the processes by which that information is gathered and then released to the public. In other words, we're not being critical here. We're just trying to be analytical. And it seems as if there's a lot of information that was coming out from law enforcement on specifics regarding the shooting, some of which was very surprising. For example, almost immediately the FBI said there was no connections whatsoever to terrorists, which was surprising since no one seemed to know anything about the guy, at least initially. So let's start with the FBI. How do they know that this guy had no ties to terrorism when no one seemed to know anything about him?
Yeah, that's a question to which I really don't have a logical answer. I think that was more of a knee-jerk reaction in terms of just kind of looking at the individual. They knew, like you said, very, very darn little about him. But there were no materials. There was no manifesto. There was no immediately apparent connection. Of course, now, as we record this radio program, things can change in the next 42 to 72 hours. So we may discover that there is some sort of a connection to a left-wing conspiracy group, a right-wing conspiracy group, an Al-Qaeda type or an ISIS type. We just don't know. And let me kind of back up and say, the initial reports on most of these types of events are usually wrong.
Yeah.
The initial information is, it's the kind of this fog of war, if you will, Clausewitz type of situation where you're really trying to figure out stuff very quickly. The public demands on one side, give us information as fast as you can, but we also want it as accurate as you can. And that's kind of going back to, I think it's called Fitt's Law, where you can't be as fast and as accurate as you want to be. It's like building a house. You want it cheap, built quickly, and done well. Well, you can choose two of those. You can't have all three, right?
Yeah.
So you can have information disseminated quickly, but it may not necessarily be accurate because there's so much information pouring in from so many different angles. Think about the dispatch center, the 911 call takers. When that gunfire started ringing out, hundreds of calls coming in, probably isolating various different locations. No one knew what was going on. It was 10 minutes of hell, of fusillade of hell. And there's so much that you have to put together in the aftermath of that, or even actually in the response to it. So we learned earlier this week that the security guard was actually, it seems now at this time, was shot before the 10 minutes of gunfire instead of after, which was the initial report, right? So there was this 6-minute period of, was he reporting in over radio or the hotel phone? What was the role of the maintenance worker? How did he communicate what was going on? And even if they could have gotten coppers up to that floor at, you know, within that 6-minute window, and that's a highly implausible thing, by the way, but if they could have, they wouldn't have entered the room right away. They would have had to stage and create a plan. And then, of course, if gunfire starts breaking out, it's all bets are off and we're going to charge the door and breach it and get in. But so the answer to your question is we didn't know enough early that we could confirm. And, you know, to your point about the FBI and saying there's no connection to terrorism, we may discover that to be untrue at some point down the line.
Well, that seems to be kind of a large, you had said that a lot of times the initial reports are wrong. Well, we have certainly seen that as far as the FBI is concerned with the Orlando shooter, the San Bernardino shooters, Fort Hood, and so on. I can understand, you know, the first blush kind of reactions, but I mean, that's kind of a major thing to be saying, oh, there's no terrorism at all. But then, yes, there is a lot of terrorism. Why even say anything at all? Just say we're investigating.
Yeah, and that would be the, from an operational standpoint, from my perspective, and even from a, you know, long, long ago, I was a public relations guy and a communications person and a crisis communications specialist. That's what I would have advised to say is we don't know and we're investigating. That would be my initial reaction, because you can't, then you can't walk that back. You know, if suddenly we've discovered that, you know, in one of his laptops or in some bank vault or safe deposit box, he's got this, you know, Inspire magazine copies and all this other stuff, then okay, well, oops, we were wrong on that. So for me, saying less in the immediate aftermath is better, until you really gather the information and you do the investigation in a thorough way.
Yeah, well, I certainly think in that situation, less is better, simply because I think by constantly having to contradict yourself and correct the record that, yes, in fact, there was terrorism, I think all that does is end up breaking trust with the FBI. So let's go ahead and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more with Doug Wiley talking about the Las Vegas shooter. And coming up, we'll be talking about some of those still unanswered questions. Stay with us. And we're back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to Doug Wiley. He's the editor-at-large for Police One. That's policeone.com. And the number is spelled out there. They provide police training content and expert analysis on a wide range of topics and trends that affect the law enforcement community. A fantastic site, filled with a ton of great articles. Even if you're not a law enforcement officer, I would certainly recommend it. They just have great insights from a law enforcement officer's perspective. So in terms of that new timeline that has come out there in the Las Vegas shooting, I mean, the first one was that the gunman had opened fire. A security guard came to the room due to a smoke alarm, and then the shooter shot at the guard and then killed himself, which stopped the shooting. And now the new one comes out that the security guard had been drawn to the room due to a door alarm going off. He then heard drilling or some other noises in the room and tried to enter. The shooter heard him in the hallway and opened fire on him. There's some reports saying there's as many as 200 rounds were fired at him. After wounding the guard, the shooter then opened fire on the crowd below, continuing for about 10 minutes. At which point the shooter then turned a gun on himself. A lot of unanswered questions here. First of all, the guard was apparently accompanied by a maintenance man. Why didn't one or the other correct that misinformation that had initially been put out?
Well, I can't get in the head of either Jesus Campos or the maintenance guy whose name unfortunately escapes me at the present time. But for me, that there's this 6-minute period of lapse between when this 200 rounds go through the door and hit miraculously. I think he was hit just once in the leg.
Yes, that is also very odd.
He's extremely fortunate. But, you know, the gunman whose name merits no mention in this space. I will never name any of these assailants. But the gunman apparently threw 200 rounds at the guard because he had these cameras set up so that he could determine whether or not he was being approached. My guess, my assumption, this is purely speculation here, is that he wasn't fully ready to unleash his attack. He was maybe loading magazines. He was maybe he just wasn't ready to do what he had intended that Sunday night to do. And so you had 6 minutes of him hastily, you know, putting magazines together, hastily probably lining guns up in a row, preparing to bash out the windows to, you know, but he wasn't ready. And so that's why you had this 6 minute probably window. We may never know. We may find out he was reading a magazine. We have no idea. We probably won't ever know. But there was, according to this new timeline, this period of time between when the security officer, Jesus Campos, was shot in the leg. He then went to the elevator lobby. And then, you know, for 10 minutes, roughly 10 minutes from 10 after to around 20 after, committed his atrocity and on the crowd there in Las Vegas. There are things I think we can begin to get to know. We were talking in the first segment there about how the investigation is still ongoing and it's unfolding, and we'll continue to dig from a law enforcement perspective to find out what this guy's life was about. They'll get into his laptop. They'll get into his bank accounts. They'll get into every little last fiber of his life. And even in so doing, we might not know his motive in the end.
Well, in terms of the information gathering, is that a little surprising that he seemed to have been kind of almost a ghost out there? He doesn't seem to have much of an online presence. Certainly, they haven't been able to find any social media that I'm aware of yet. I mean, is that what you would expect for somebody of his age?
As I said on the Policing Matters podcast on Friday with my partner, Jim Dudley, who's a former deputy chief of police here in San Francisco, he doesn't quite fit the profile, but that doesn't really mean anything because the profile is now kind of out the window. He kind of was a loner. I was mentioning on the podcast, his game of choice was apparently video poker, which is a terribly lonely, isolated game. I mean, if I don't gamble, but if I play cards, I want to play cards with people. You know, I want to have fun with my friends and or just opponents, you know, people I don't know. Video poker is a very isolating game. There was a report that this this prostitute, for lack of a better word, in Las Vegas, you know, she had encounters with him, I'll put it that way, in which she felt like he had kind of really violent thoughts. You know, he had, she alleges, rape fantasies and, you know, choking her during intercourse and just kind of really awful, you know, heinous things. So I think that we will find that there were signs. My friend and colleague here at Police One, Dan Marku, outlines the five phases of the active shooter, or the active killer, I prefer to call them. And at some point during that five phase period, there's going to be a tell. Like, for example, in San Bernardino, the neighbor was like, something's kind of hinky about them, but I don't want to report them because I don't want to seem like I'm, you know, profiling or racially insensitive or what have you. There may have been at some point someone in this assailant's life who kind of raised an eyebrow. It might have even been the prostitute who went, that's weird, but I can't report him because I'm committing an illegal act with him. So, I don't want to. What was the circumstance of your meeting, Ms.? Oh, yeah, he was paying me for sex. Yeah. Not a good look.
Yeah, we got about a minute here with you. Getting back to the shooter and the new timeline, it had made kind of sense that he shot himself when he did under the old timeline. Now it's kind of questionable. Do you have any thoughts on why he would kill himself at that particular moment rather than continuing either his onslaught or going after the police that he knew were going to be on the way?
Well, this is, again, speculation on my part. I'm not read in on the investigation. I'm working on open source information just like you. It's possible that he had so many malfunctions because if you're unleashing that many rounds, your barrel's going to heat up pretty quick. And so he's probably dumping guns and changing magazines and what have you. And he might have just decided, I can't win a fight with the guys who are going to come in this door. And that's typically the case. I mean, most of these active killers kill themselves at the sound of the sirens. when the sirens start coming, they're like, okay, I don't really want to be here anymore. And they end the problem themselves and, you know, give taxpayers a break on the trial costs.
Yeah, well, I remember that from our last interview, that a lot of times that they will kill themselves simply when they hear the sirens. All right, fascinating discussion here with Doug Wiley, editor-at-large for Police One. You can visit them at policeone.com and stay with us. We'll have more of those puzzles coming out of Las Vegas. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Doug Wiley. He's editor-at-large for Police One, the most trusted online destination for law enforcement agencies and police departments worldwide. Again, they have a tremendous amount of information, resources, articles. If you are a law enforcement officer or know someone who is, I highly recommend that you go check them out, policeone.com. And in terms of not only the timeline, but also just, you know, in the aftermath of the shooting there at Las Vegas, I have been kind of letting your thoughts roll around in my head there about that he was basically interrupted. And that would seem to make some sense because the guns are kind of scattered around that room. And if he got interrupted, if somebody came to the door before he was ready to go, there's also some speculation that he was waiting for somebody, I think, that maybe there was a second shooter that hadn't arrived yet. Do you know if they have found out any information about that?
The latest information that I have is that that's untrue, that he had no relationship with anyone else that would have been going to commit this atrocity. He sent his girlfriend overseas. Like he was trying to push people away from him, not bring people into his group. Now, the only plausible, again, speculation is that there were two windows blown out, but that's not unusual for I'm going to use the word sniper, but he wasn't a sniper. He was a killer. It's not unusual to have two different nests or perches from which you may, you know, look at, have overwatch over a larger area. But I think that he acted alone. I really don't. I haven't heard anything to the effect that there was a connection to another killer. And that would really surprise me if that came out to be true.
Well, in terms of training for this sort of thing, I mean, this guy is 64 years old. He didn't look like he was in the best of shape. In terms of firing those guns, how much training would he have needed to undertake in terms of like going to, you know, various shooting ranges or anything like that? I mean, or are these simply basically aim and pull the trigger and you don't necessarily need to worry about any kind of training for that?
Well, I mean, I do an awful lot of firearms training. I do it with law enforcement. I do it with ex-military. I consider myself to be a fairly good marksman. But you don't have to be that good to hit a crowd of people that's basically the size of a football field and just unload rounds. It's just what they call spray and pray. You're not hitting very specific targets from 400 yards or 200 yards or wherever he was away. That's difficult. That takes training. But to just unleash with this bump stock thing, and I'm a big Second Amendment guy, but I have no idea why that thing was even brought to market under the Obama administration. That's just not that difficult to do. Hitting the fuel tank over at the airport, a little more difficult, but the thing is, you know, the size of a building practically. Hitting the size of a side of a barn ain't that difficult. And particularly because he wasn't that far away. He's not taking a 1,000-yard shot. He's taking 200-yard shots. It's just not that difficult to do. So I don't think he did a whole lot of training. I mean, we'll find out if he had had a membership at a gun club or, you know, any kind of tie to, you know, a firearms, you know, club or group, but it's entirely plausible. He watched some YouTube videos about how to figure out trajectories, taking shots from a higher ground. He did apparently have notes on what distances he was shooting at. He might have had a range finder, which you can buy for $60 at any kind of sporting goods store. And from that point on, it's just pulling the trigger and killing people. And that's just the awful, awful truth of what this assailant did.
Well, in terms of selecting the guns that he did, because he had a variety of them, do you suspect he was a true gun collector that had an interest in these sort of things, or is he just looking for something to cause carnage?
I would guess the latter, unfortunately. I know a lot of people, a lot of my friends collect guns. We have vintage guns. We have guns we won't ever shoot because, you know, they're that old. We just treasure them as museum pieces. And then, of course, there's tactical weapons that I would have in my home to protect myself, my family. Friends of mine are hunters and go out with their guns. I don't think he was an enthusiast. I think he was a crazy person. I think he was, this is again speculation on my part. I think he was just trying to get the next high score. I think he was trying to be the worst killer in American history, and he achieved that. Let me quickly point out, he killed 58 people and injured more than 500 others. There was a person in Nice, France, who killed 86 people and injured 434.
Yeah.
Didn't have a gun. Just drove a big box truck through the crowd. So it's when you have a person who's set on killing and get, again, achieving that next high score, you have to look at the perpetrator and not the tool. You have to look at the violent offender and not the manner with which they will, you know, you can blame airplanes for 9/11 all day long, but airplanes are a really useful tool to get across the country. So, you know, when we get into this kind of discussion around what was his motive, my theory, my working theory now is that he was just trying to beat the Orlando, quote, finger quotes in the air high score.
Yeah, and that said, and you're right to point out that it's not guns. In fact, one of the great articles that you guys have up there is that it says that evil exists, and people have to recognize that. And it's not about the guns. It's not about the tool, as you say, to do the killing. It's just people are evil, and evil will find a way to kill when it wants to kill. And I was actually very pleasantly surprised to see your writer put that up there, because that's just something that you don't often hear in the media.
And that's Mike Wood. He's one of the firearms instructors that I do train under. He's ex-military. He's Air Force and a very, very well-trained operator. And he understands, you know, I think quite well, quite vividly, that, you know, if you have a person with nefarious, evil intent, to use his word, it's going to be difficult to stop them, even if you, well, this assailant passed every background check. There was nothing in his background, like a domestic violence charge or misdemeanor drug charges or any kind of felony conviction. He didn't have that, and therefore he was legally able to amass this arsenal in his home 80 miles from Las Vegas. And let me point one other thing out to you about what my working theory is of his attack plan was. He was a regular at this hotel. He knew this hotel quite well. He had access, because he was a high roller, to the service elevator in the hotel. He was commonly seen there. And I believe that he saw an advertisement 10 months ago, 12 months ago, that there was going to be this big concert. And it was going to be right there at the corner where he usually stayed. And that's when he began to hatch his plan. And he purchased guns over the course of about a year. You know, you don't get proficient in firearms in 1 year. You get proficient in firearms in a lifetime. And I think that he just hatched this plan to commit the worst atrocity other than, you know, the terrorist attacks of 9/11 in modern American history.
And that is so disturbing if that's the case, somebody put that much time and effort into planning this. And like we said earlier, evil does exist. And I think that's what you see with this case as well. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we will be talking about some of the changes as a result of the Las Vegas shooting, and also what you as a citizen can be doing in these types of situations. Stay with us.
Get a little intelligence on big government. You're listening to the iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back. This is iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Doug Wiley. He's the editor-at-large for Police One, the most comprehensive and trusted online destination for law enforcement officers and agencies. That is policeone.com. And, of course, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. So in this last segment that we have you for, there's still a lot of questions that remain. There's a lot of puzzles, a lot of things that still just don't fit. But In the wake of this shooting, what are some changes that you would anticipate as a result of this? New trainings, perhaps, and especially how can law enforcement officers really learn to put themselves in the heads of these people when they are so evil?
Well, the first thing that I thought of when I started seeing this unfolding a couple of Sundays ago was I've taken a lot of counterterrorism training with a person whose name I can't share on air. But what he has taught me is what's called red teaming, is to go to a location and just assess how you would turn that place into a chaotic mess like this assailant did. You have to, and I would go down to that venue and I would have looked up and seen that high ground and gone immediately, we got to lock that building down. We got to have 6 days before the event of checking bags randomly and on the regular. Now, you can't do that on a sustained basis at a hotel of that size, but you can do it for a number of days to sterilize the area. And that's what you would do when there's any kind of diplomatic, visit the Pope, the president, what have you. But I would have gone to that scene as a security, consultant and gone, that's the first place I'm going to go to make sure that we're secure, because that's the high ground that's nearest to the venue. I would also have looked at the airport. You know, certainly that's an opportunity. If you have, again, a crazy 9/11 style attack, that airport, you could just overfly the runway and go right into that scene. You could go right into the Mandalay Bay. And it would take a corporate jet. You couldn't do it on a commercial jet anymore. But if you have a G5, think about, you can't take your own moral compass into this conversation. We have like our, we value life and we are there to protect people. You have to think like the bad guy. You can't take your morals into that conversation. You have to go to the deepest, darkest recesses of your mind in order to figure out, well, what would the bad guy do to make this place, a kill box, which is exactly what it was.
Well, in terms of the average citizen that is out there, heaven forbid they ever find themselves in this kind of situation. But we know that this is certainly not the last of these kinds of attacks. We know that there's going to be more. And judging by this kind of mindset and this kind of level of evil that exists out there, somebody is going to be trying to top this record. And whether they're using a gun or they're using a van or whatever else they will come up with, why don't you walk us through what the average Joe or Jill public needs to know about these kinds of situations? What should their responses be? And also, how can they assist law enforcement officers?
First off, I want to say a word of praise for a guy named Taylor Winston. This was a retired Marine veteran, two tours of in Iraq. He created a hastily assembled plan to help save lives. He literally stole a truck, a pickup truck, and made three trips to the hospital before the ambulance could get there. The presence of mind to know to just even go to an assembly of trucks at a venue like that and thinking, yeah, people share those trucks and we're going to have to, leave the keys in the truck. Fantastic. In Boston, when the Boston Marathon bombing happened, people used their clothes and their belts to create tourniquets. Now, I, as a civilian, I carry a tourniquet. I have hemostatic gauze. I have chest bandages. I have that on my person almost every day. If I don't, then it's because I've left my backpack at home or I've got to go someplace where I can't get that stuff into the venue. But people can take classes like Red Cross or CERT or NERT or go to your local police department and say, do you have a Citizens Academy? Can I take a class with your Citizens Academy? Can I go to the fire station or the EMS provider and say, can you give me a little bit of training so that you have that, at least the confidence to say, I'm going to help in just the tiniest way possible. Taylor Winston saved countless lives. He probably transported 30 people to the hospital just because he went, okay, I can do that. That's what I can do. And he got back to the venue and he found that the EMS people, the fire folks, the police were there, and they took over for him. But he was the first responder there. And that's the case with all these people who go to these events. You have to think of yourself as the first responder and know what your capabilities are. Increase your capabilities and find ways to take classes or give yourself the confidence to say, I can just hold my hand on a bleeding person without getting sick or fainting or passing out. You have to begin to give yourself those tools And then, you know, that's when you get these heroes who come to the fore. In all of these events, you have stories of people who are carrying people out of the Orlando nightclub who had no training, but they knew to do it. They figured out what to do in that emergency response.
Hmm. I got about a minute here. There are three takeaways from one of your articles up there is in terms of finding yourself in these kind of situations. First, you have to recognize the sound of gunfire and also be aware that if it sounds like gunfire, it probably is in this kind of atmosphere. And then also moving targets are harder to hit, so run.
Yep.
And then find cover, not just concealment. That means getting behind something that can actually protect you. And so, again, I would like to point people to PoliceOne.com. There are some great articles up there, and of course we'll link those up on iSpyRadio.com as well. Doug, thanks for your time, and best wishes to you guys as you continue to build out Police One.
Mark Anderson, it's a pleasure to talk with you. I'm hopeful I was helpful. And if you ever have need to talk with me again, I'm certainly available for you.
Yes, we will certainly avail ourselves of that. Looking forward to more discussions about that red team. So, all right, Doug Wiley, thank you so much. This segment of iSpy is sponsored by Landmark Pacific. Don't just build the building, build the landmark. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talking now to David Hardy. After 10 years in the Interior Department, he is now a practicing attorney in Tucson, Arizona. He is also the author of 4 published books. One of those, a New York Times bestselling, was that the Michael Moore's A Big Fat Stupid White Man? Was that it?
That's the one.
Wow. Yeah. A great book there. And he is also the author of 25 law review articles, which have twice been cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. He has a new book out, though, just released this week. I'm from the government and I'm here to kill you. The true human cost of official negligence. I mean, wow. And very timely, unfortunately, with everything that's going on in Las Vegas. And that's what I'd really like to start talking to you about. We've been talking about that with our other guests. And with some new issues coming out with the way that communications department has rolled things out, there's been a change in timeline, among some other things. What are your overall thoughts as an attorney about this investigation?
It doesn't sound like it's being done too terribly well. But a large part of it is that at the moment, we still have absolutely no idea what this guy's motivation was.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no indication that he showed signs of insanity, for example. He was very concise in his planning. He was plainly in touch with reality, at least if we use that definition of mental illness. But, was he a terrorist? Was it something else? We have no idea of his motivation, except that presumably, we can probably guess to a high degree of certainty that he was driven by an enormous hatred. Because he obviously envisioned killing himself as part of it. If the timeline that we now have holds true, it looks like he was firing for about 10 minutes and then presumably killed himself because there's no more gunshots. And the police didn't get in until an hour later, so it wasn't like, he shot himself as police were entering the door. No, he shot himself well before they came upon him.
Yeah, and that's one of the enduring puzzles in terms of the timing of that guy killing himself. I don't know if we will ever necessarily have an answer to that. Your new book, which we'll talk about more in the next segment, but it's titled I'm From the Government and I'm Here to Kill You, seems to just lead right into this because we've got the FBI immediately saying no terrorist connection despite the fact we didn't know anything about him. But the FBI got it wrong in Orlando. They got it wrong in San Bernardino and Fort Hood. They said there's no terrorism in all of those cases, and then we find out it most certainly is terrorism. And I personally get frustrated with this because my research area is in trust, and I've asked 2 other guests this same thing. But let's get your thoughts on this. Why does the FBI do this? I mean, is their communications officer so unaware of how that breaks down trust with the public?
I think they don't much care. Mm. if they're in the government, it's just, we're going to... You assume your agency is all-powerful and all good, and nobody will question that. And if you started to question it, then that would show that you weren't really a team player. So if you form this collective consciousness where certain things are true and certain things are not true. When I was in the government, I referred to it as institutional psychosis.
Mm.
because what they cared about was our position, not the fact. Facts were unimportant. The question was, what position did we take? And if the agency took the position that it's dark at noon, by gosh, you better sign on with that view. It's dark right now. Question, and people will start thinking strangely of you. I mean, why are you denying our position? I once had one bureaucrat get all upset over, I sent the client agency report of what happened in the courtroom. Perfectly ordinary report. We argued this, they argued that, the judge said this. And he was really worried that, you know, that might not be our position, and you shouldn't have talked to the client. And I said, I'm saying what happened in the courtroom. How can you have a position on what happened?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm your only guy in there. They could buy a transcript if they wanted to know what happened. It's an objective reality. We can't have a position on something that, you know, an objective reality. I don't think he ever understood what I was saying.
Well, it certainly does seem to, from a public standpoint, it certainly does seem to be more about protecting the agency than it does about protecting the truth or getting the truth out there. But again, it just comes across as incompetence on some levels, or that there's some political agenda. But, you know, I could kind of understand it when Obama was in office, just because that he was so favorable towards Islam and Muslims in general. And so they're going to be trying to cover as much as they could, I would guess. But we've got a new administration in office that kind of is taking the opposite viewpoint on this. So why the FBI is so certain that he has absolutely no ties to any terrorist groups, I just don't understand why they immediately went there. Especially, you know, we had a guest on last week that talked about this in the fact that you don't have to be a member of ISIS to receive support from ISIS. And I wonder if that is a connection that they just haven't even decided to go down that path yet.
Well, it's remember, the administrations may have changed, but the federal bureaucracy, depending on how you want to count, is somewhere between 1 and 2 million people. And our only power to change things is election affects two of them, president and vice president. So, you know, there may be a new administration in town, but the public relations officer is acting under his last instructions, and his superior probably is sympathetic to those last instructions.
I think that's a great point. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we'll be talking about his new book, just released, I'm From the Government and I'm Here to Kill You, The True Human Cost of Official Negligence. Stay with us. Landmark Pacific is known for their outstanding steel buildings and general contracting. But did you know that they're also a fantastic choice to maintain your existing building? When new construction isn't an option, maintaining your existing pre-engineered steel building is absolutely imperative. Incorrect materials can greatly reduce the life of your metal roof. For metal re-roofs, repairs, or additions and remodels, call the experts at Landmark Pacific, 503-743-3256. That's 503-743-3256. And welcome back. We're in our final segment this week on iSpy Radio. We're talking today to David Hardy. He is the author of the book, I'm From the Government and I'm Here to Kill You. And, you know, I am so glad that somebody has written a book like this, because that has been one of the things that we have been so frustrated with pretty much since day one here on iSpy, that you can see people either through sheer incompetence or bad planning or whatever else in the government, and there is just never any consequences for bad decision making.
As often as not, the consequence is promotion or a bonus. VA hospital system, most of those most responsible for the veterans' deaths got bonuses for the year. The remaining cases in the book, for the most part, nobody was so much as reprimanded. I think in the wake of, which one was it? Ruby Ridge, the shooting of Vicki Weaver. Those responsible, the people most responsible for covering up got letters of reprimand. That was it.
Wow.
So, yeah. If a private company did what the government has done in any chapter of the book, their leadership would be prosecuted and the company sued into oblivion, and the government would be out there posing righteously indignant. We're protecting you from this sort of selfish behavior. The government itself does it. Hey, no big deal.
Yeah. Well, the double standard there is just shocking. And like you said, is that not only is nobody ever fired, but a lot of times they're actually promoted up the ladder. I'm just going to read this little bit here from the Amazon description. It says, the book examines how we came to this pass. American courts misconstrued and expanded the old legal concept of sovereign immunity. The king can do no wrong. And I think that is it in a nutshell in terms of how our government behaves. There is just isn't any consequences. A lot of times there's incompetence, but sometimes there is willful negligence. There's the example, well, and I think in a lot of ways, sometimes that willful negligence and willingness to do harm sometimes leads to conspiracy theories. You've got what happened there in the 40s, 50s, and 60s there with the experiments on black Americans. And so you hear those kinds of things. And, of course, you know, if they're doing that, then why wouldn't they do something else?
Oh, yeah. I have little side notes in the book about other things that have happened for which no one was accountable, like they released certain germs off the California coast, I think near San Francisco, to study if you could stage a germ warfare attack on the area. And generally, they only gave you a mild cold. However, some people were vulnerable, and it killed at least one person. Nobody was accountable for that.
Wow.
You know, Texas City explosion, 1946. They managed to blow flat a third of Texas City and kill 600 people. The lawsuit went up to the Supreme Court that said, nope, you can't sue. There's absolutely no accountability there.
Well, how have we come to this point? I mean, because you would think that, you know, a government for the people, by the people, and in theory responsible to the people, you would think that they would not be able to treat people like they're cattle. I mean, how have we arrived at this?
Well, a big part of it is the expansion of the federal government. It was designed to be an extremely small institution. I think the first office of the Secretary of State had something like 8 employees. With that sort of establishment, there's minimal opportunity to harm people. It's expanded into a 1 to 2 million person bureaucracy. Our only control is at an election to elect the one or two, the two people who will be at the top of the 1 million or 2 million people. Any state has, you know, any state you vote not only for governor, but also attorney general, secretary of state, that sort of thing. So it was designed to be a small government. It's become an enormous one and gotten totally out of control.
Well, it is shocking to think that our own government abuses our citizens like this. Now, you talk about some remedies within the book as well. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a peek at that?
Well, I want to rewrite the Federal Tort Claims Act to make the government more suable, more accountable. Also allow states to prosecute federal employees if their conduct not only broke the criminal law of the state, but also violated the U.S. Constitution. You might say they're outside their job description if they're violating the Constitution that gives them power. So things like that. I think there's a lot of potential there for bringing the federal establishment back under control. But if not, it's lethal.
Yeah.
You really want to see something. Look, I've established a web page for the book with the evidence on it. It's www.officialnegligence.com. And go to the tab that deals with video and pictorial evidence. You'll see some things that will open your eyes. I mean, FBI radio traffic at Waco, ATF radio traffic at the same. The official reason why they had to go in violently at Waco was given that Koresh never left the building, so he cannot be arrested peacefully. I found out what some two undercover agents did 9 days before that raid and shootout. They went shooting with David Koresh. It's in their own report.
Yes.
Signed by them and their superiors.
Yes, I remember hearing about that, that they apparently were buddies with the guy. Unfortunately, yeah. We are up against the clock here. That website is officialnegligence.com, and we'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. David, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, so happy to be here.
His book, one more time, is I'm From the Government and I'm Here to Kill You, The True Human Cost of Official Negligence. And if you missed that, just head to ispyradio.com and look on our store page. Also, we have an update from a previous show. They are still collecting signatures for a petition to help pass the Stop Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act that will reverse the expansion of taxpayer-funded abortions. Head to ispyradio.com for more information there. Plus, we hope to have some news on that very soon, so stay tuned for that. And we hope to see you next week here on the iSpy Radio Show. Help us spread the word, won't you? Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a faith
that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.